landscape. He was given $1.6 billion in mid-2022 to lead this crusade. It's a very orchestrated campaign. They have put out a lot of communications just tainting the acronym ESG, saying that it's somehow, you know, it's a bad thing to do, even though in a recent survey by IBM, 5,000 C-suite executives in 22 countries across 22 industries, 79% of them said that they use sustainability and ESG in order to maximize their profits. This is the market. The market has spoken. 181 companies in the Business Roundtable signed an agreement for stakeholder capitalism. That means that you take care of your employees, you take care of your customers, the communities where you operate, and your supply chains, and that leads to greater competitive strength and good and profits for your shareholders. That was in 2019.
We're now
in the
seconds.
Implementation phase. So the bottom line is the pro-ESG is all about profit maximization, about long-term sustainable growth, and the anti-ESG, they're losing money, and it's anti-business, anti-freedom, and frankly, anti-capitalist.
Andrew Behar is the CEO of As You Sow, a nonprofit promoting environmental and social corporate responsibility through shareholder advocacy. His group is being investigated by the House Judiciary Committee, along with a number of others, for alleged antitrust activity. That does it for our show. A happy pre-birthday to Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without you, our listeners. And if you missed out on any of our programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the DNA of a man convicted of killing Portland activist Sean Kelleher connects him to a 20-year-old rape case.
Portland pays out over $300,000 in police violence settlements in the first 3 months of the year.
And in national news, hotel workers in LA who have been on strike since this summer win better wages and benefits in their new contract.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 29th, 2024. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Christopher Knipe killed Portland activist Sean Kelleher with his vehicle in 2019 and is now linked by DNA to a decades-old rape case. Portland police did not pursue additional charges against Knipe because the statute of limitations on a rape case from 2003 had likely expired. Knipe evaded justice for almost 3 years for the killing of Kelleher, a well-known Portland activist, but he may have been dodging sexual assault charges for even longer. In 2019, after Knipe killed 23-year-old Kelleher and fled the crime scene, law enforcement collected DNA from the car left at the site of the crash. Knipe's DNA was traced to the rape of a woman that took place in southeast Portland in 2003. How much the police investigated the rape is unclear because of redactions in the records provided to OPB for their coverage of this story. Until recently, the statute of limitations for first-degree rape cases was 12 years. But in the 2023 legislative session, Oregon lawmakers extended it to 20 years. The extension left a narrow window to prosecute a rape case against Knipe. Despite knowing about the DNA report since 2019, Portland police opted not to contact the victim due to a trauma-informed perspective that hearing from detectives decades later can reopen painful memories. However, the future of the case is unclear since Oregon law officers, prosecutors, avenues around the statute of limitations, in particular types of sexual assault cases when DNA evidence surfaces. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office is currently reviewing the 2003 case and considering next steps.
In the first 3 months of 2024, the City of Portland's Office of Risk Management paid out a total of $364,000 in 4 settlements related to lawsuits over police violence. 3 of those settlements were related to protests in 2020, while the other was a $100,000 payment to the estate of Coben Hendrickson, a 51-year-old man shot and killed by a Portland cop during a mental health crisis in 2019. The largest payment in 2024 so far, $158,000, was made in January to Angelica Clark, who was injured by police during a protest on July 26, 2020. At the hearing before council, Portland Cop Watch described the incident, and Ms. Clark talked about how it affected her life.
According to court records, which also contain photographic evidence, on the night of July 25th, 2020, Ms. Clark, a Black woman, participated in a protest against police violence and in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Around 2:15 a.m. on January 26, 2020, PPB officers repeatedly beat Ms. Clark as she followed orders to disperse. Court records state that one officer hit Ms. Clark with his baton and pushed her into a wall. Another officer hit her with his outstretched baton, and a third officer put his hand on her face, violently ripped off her mask and goggles, and pepper sprayed her directly into the eyes.
Prior to this assault, I had experienced life, school, work, studies as a social work grad, grief, and endured traumatic experiences walking alongside close family and friends. During those times, I was able to show up for my friends and family while maintaining a balance for myself. This meant finding sound ways to cope with those situations in order to function accordingly. Following the assault on my body by Portland police, however, I noticed within myself the inability to function outside of survivor mode and could not use the same self-care practices and techniques I had once used before in the same manner. Every morning and every day, my body was constantly overwhelmed by the cortisol running through me. I began to overwork myself in order to avoid the pain, the hypervigilance, the constant desire to keep moving, out of the fear. I began to make decisions out of position of survival and necessity, praying that the anger, the pain, and loss of my entire sense of self that I had endured that day would subside, and I could once again function as I was once able to before. Unfortunately, that day has changed me forever.
That was Angelica Clark, who received the largest settlement yet this year from the city over injuries she sustained from police during the 2020 protests. Last year, Portland paid out over $1.1 million to settle lawsuits over police behavior, as well as 2 property damage claims related to police violence vehicle collisions. Out of 15 total payouts in 2023, 10 were related to protests in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Next week, City Council is set to approve another $35,000 payment to settle a claim from Anthem Apartments on Inner East Burnside Street, stemming from a police vehicle collision.
Employees at Oregon Early Learning Division say the agency is troubled by inequity, racism, and mismanagement. This comes from a report from Investigate West earlier this week. Through public records, they found documentation of racist incidents and an exodus of BIPOC professionals from the department. The Early Learning Division manages the state-funded network of child care programs and early education programs like preschools. One employee wrote to Governor Tina Kotek's chief of staff asking for intervention, warning the governor of the, quote, racist environment in the department that was causing managers of color to leave. In one instance, a child was called the N-word, and the agency did not immediately investigate. In another, managers repeated racist stereotypes that certain communities of color consider physical discipline and child abuse to be normal. At least five managers, including three who are people of color, decided to leave the department in the past 18 months. The employee pushed for better training and education for managers and workers, but she says those efforts were rebuffed. Other employees highlighted parallel dysfunctions at the Early Learning Division, which has struggled to get funding and contracts out to child care providers in time.
The Jewell School District in Clatsop County sued the State Department of Forestry last week to try to stop them from implementing a new forest conservation plan. The district says it will lose nearly $1 million in revenue if the new plan goes forward and that it will be forced to cut staff and services. The Jewell District is in northwest Oregon in the heart of Timber County, and it's home to roughly 145 students. It relies on timber revenues for 100% of its budget. The lawsuit is based on an administrative rule that the Oregon Department of Forestry harvest enough timber on state lands to pay its own bills. Oregon has been trying for years to implement a new habitat conservation plan for state forests in Tillamook and Clatsop counties. The plan would prohibit logging in some areas and protect the state from lawsuits about federally protected endangered species that live there. It was approved earlier this month by the Oregon Board of Forestry in a close vote. Most of Oregon's public school funding comes from state income taxes. Roughly half the forest land in Clatsop County is owned by real estate investment trusts like Weyerhaeuser, who don't pay income or corporate taxes to the state or county.
The Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, closed Interstate 5 South through Portland Thursday afternoon to repair a failing bridge joint. A bridge joint holds together elevated sections of the highway, like where the road crosses over creeks, roads, and other underpasses. ODOT says it's not uncommon for these joints to fail, as one did yesterday over Greeley Avenue. But if it's not fixed immediately, it becomes unsafe for people to drive over and can lead the concrete to crack. They responded to calls from drivers on I-5 who noted significant potholes. A photo tweeted by ODOT taken from under the highway overpass shows visible light through the pothole, where concrete came tumbling down onto the road below. To repair it, crews form up the concrete underneath, chip out the old concrete, and then replace the old joint and repave it. Lanes were closed around 5 p.m. yesterday and were reopened after the cement cured for 3 to 4 hours at just around midnight.
Unionized hotel workers in Southern California have been on the picket line for months, but this week employees at 34 hotels ratified new contract agreements. The new contracts secure higher wages and better benefits for thousands of housekeepers, cooks, and other workers. The strike started last summer, organized by labor union Unite Here Local 11, with intermittent strikes at 60 different hotels. Some of them haven't come to an agreement yet, but some of LA's most high-profile luxury hotels have. The approved contracts cover hotels like the Beverly Hilton and the Waldorf Astoria. Workers will get an immediate $5 an hour raise and will see their total wages boosted by $10 an hour over the life of their contract. That's especially important in Los Angeles, where wages for workers don't come close to the cost of rent in the area that they work in. Hotels will also increase pension contributions and investments in healthcare for the workers. Kurt Peterson is the co-president of Unite Here Local 11. Peterson told the LA Times, quote, "The agreement, we are using the term life-changing because it truly is, from affordable health insurance to probably the best pension for service workers in the country. The real game changer is the wages. We said this about people being able to afford to live where they work, and we've taken an enormous stride to enable people to do that." The contract also secures extra protections for immigrant workers who don't have papers and cleans the slate for workers who were disciplined for participating in union strike actions. Strikes continue at dozens of other hotels, and organizers say that their fight will continue. They say their efforts are even more important because of the high-profile events coming to LA in the next few years, namely the World Cup in 2026 and the Summer Olympics in 2028.
On to politics, where Republicans are floating conspiracy theories on the collapse of Baltimore's Key Bridge. South Carolina's congressional elections will be using a map ruled unconstitutional, and the Senate schedules an impeachment trial for Homeland Secretary Mayorkas. With more on those stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Whatever color you are, whatever sexual orientation you are, whatever your heritage is, you want to be safe.
Republican New Jersey Congressman Jeff Van Drew says Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg worries more about pronouns than the safety of America's infrastructure. Since the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, right-wing comments have linked the accident to diversity programs, immigration, even COVID lockdowns. Baltimore natives like TV producer David Chase have reacted to that with rage, calling it an insult to politicize the tragedy. Safety officials are investigating if contaminated fuel is what actually caused the cargo ship to lose power before it crashed. A federal court says it's too close to the June congressional primary to change South Carolina's districts, even though the map discriminates against black voters. The Supreme Court has yet to rule on a racial gerrymandering case about the state's first district, now held by Republican Nancy Mace. But Marvin Neal with the South Carolina State NAACP says the state shouldn't be rewarded for not dealing with the issue.
The black voters of South Carolina and across this nation deserve voting maps that work to empower, not diminish the black vote.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate impeachment trial of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas will start in 2 weeks after Congress returns from break. The largely symbolic articles of impeachment passed the House by a single vote. But Minnesota Congressman Tom Emmer insists Mayorkas has failed to enforce federal immigration laws.
House Republicans fulfilled our constitutional duty by voting to impeach. I can only hope my colleagues in the Senate will step up and do the same.
Meanwhile, Schumer is pressing Speaker Mike Johnson to schedule a House vote on an aid package for Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more help. And our allies around the world are looking at the House of Representatives, are looking at Speaker Johnson to step up.
Johnson says he'll try to pass billions in funding for Ukraine and Israel once the House returns, but his right flank opposes Ukraine aid and is already angry over his working with Democrats on the budget. Unions in Maine want a law to say thousands of farm workers will get the state's $14 minimum wage. State AFL President Cynthia Finney says farm workers were intentionally left out of federal labor laws covering wages, the right to unionize, or even demand rest breaks.
Those are things that other workers are entitled to already, and farm workers are not, and certainly farm workers work hard enough.
And finally, President Joe Biden raised an estimated $25 million at a star-studded New York City event with former presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The two are helping Biden expand his already significant cash advantage over former President Donald Trump. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 64. Today in history, in 2021, the ship Ever Given is dislodged from the Suez Canal. It ran around in a dust storm for 6 days. 6 days earlier, blocking and disrupting trade through the canal. The quote of the day is from British comedian and Monty Python member Eric Idle, who said, quote, "If anything can survive the probe of humor, it is clearly of value, and conversely, all groups who claim immunity from laughter are claiming special privileges which should not be granted."
Activists in the MMIP movement in Anchorage, Alaska, want a local musician arrested for his knowledge of a murder committed by Brian Smith. Smith was convicted last month. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of Anchorage activists in the missing and murdered Indigenous Peoples Movement say there's unfinished business in the case of Brian Smith, convicted last month for torturing and killing two Alaska Native women. They're calling for the arrest of Ian Calhoun, who so far has not been charged with any crime. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the Anchorage musician has been the target of an online petition and several protests.
Cars honked in support of about 20 protesters lined up alongside the road near Ian Calhoun's home. They stood with signs in big red letters that said, "We do not feel safe, and arrest Ian Calhoun now." Calhoun is a heavy metal drummer who allegedly exchanged text and Facebook messages with Brian Smith not long after he murdered Kathleen Henry in 2019. At the end of Smith's trial, prosecutors brought up something new in the case, evidence that Smith had courted Calhoun to be his confidant. The jury saw text messages between Smith and Calhoun in which Smith tried to arrange a time to show off Henry's body before dumping it near some railroad tracks.
Is there a group of people out there that like to look at the dead bodies of Alaska Native women? We don't know unless APD investigates further.
Antonia Comack, a Native activist and blogger, and also one of the main organizers of a series of downtown protests, says failure to report knowledge of a murder is a crime. During the trial, Calhoun's attorney invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself, so he didn't testify.
We wish that he had, so that we could have heard what it was that he witnessed.
Michael Livingston, a retired police officer, is among the protesters.
The evidence appears to indicate that he not only was aware of a crime, but rather than report the crime, he wanted to protect a now-convicted murderer.
So far, Calhoun and his attorney have not responded to requests for comment. The Anchorage District Attorney's Office and police have issued statements saying there is not enough evidence to charge Calhoun. Protesters aren't happy with that answer. Their petition has now surpassed 2,000 signatures. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A Washington state tribe is getting funding to return forest lands to tribal stewardship. Eric Tigetoff has more.
The Washington state legislature has approved $25 million in Climate Commitment Act funding to the Quinault Indian Nation on the Olympic Peninsula to purchase 11,000 acres of privately owned forest lands on their reservation. Quinault Indian Nation President Guy Capoman says the Climate Commitment Act is an important law for the state.
It shows that the efforts of not only the nation, but the state as a whole and the concern for habitat and the environment is real.
The Climate Commitment Act was passed in 2021 and created a cap and invest program to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions. 10% of revenue generated is committed to tribes. The Nature Conservancy in Washington has partnered with the tribe on the purchase. Capoman says reacquiring this forest land for the tribe is momentous.
Repatriating your lands back, I mean, what bigger goal for a tribe is there, right? Other than the wellness of their members, those are all things that are instrumental in our existence as a people.
Capoman says Indigenous people around the world have a significant role to play in combating climate change, given their connection to the land.
Knowing how to manage and deal with those resources can show and help the rest of the world in how we mitigate and adapt to what's happening in the world today.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Education experts say 37% of schools report at least one teacher vacancy, and they are calling on Congress to better fund teacher training incentives. It's a problem across the country, including on the West Coast. Suzanne Potter reports from California.
Education advocates are calling on lawmakers to increase funding for programs to combat the teacher shortage. 37% of schools nationwide report being short at least one teacher. The problem is worse at schools serving high-poverty neighborhoods where more than half report a vacancy. Susan Kemper-Patrick with the Learning Policy Institute says those numbers are troublingly high.
At least 314,000 teaching positions across the U.S. are either unfilled or filled with teachers who are not fully certified for their assignments. But this means at least 1 in 10 teaching positions nationally are either unfilled or not filled with a certified teacher.
Data from the California Commission on Teacher Credentialing showed 10,000 teacher vacancies in the 2021-2022 school year. The number of teacher credentials issued that year was down 16% from the previous year, but has now started to trend upward. In 2023, California passed a bill to make it easier for retired teachers to return to the classroom. Kemper Patrick notes that schools are resorting to desperate measures, like combining classes, relying on a virtual teacher, or using a long-term substitute.
So the U.S. Department of Education School Pulse Survey found that 36% of public schools across the U.S. reported that they had to increase class size due to teacher and staff vacancies.
Kemper Patrick blames the problem on low salaries, noting the average starting salary for a teacher nationwide is less than $43,000 a year. Congress is currently considering two bills, the Diversify Act and the Educators for America Act, which would double the amount of the Teach America grant from $4,000 to $8,000 per year. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
There's a new project underway to monitor air pollution in 12 cities with large Hispanic populations. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the U.S., Hispanic people are disproportionately exposed to harmful air pollution. They're more likely to work outdoors in agriculture or construction, so they may be more exposed to wildfire smoke. And in many areas, neighborhoods with large Hispanic populations are more likely to be located near highways or oil and gas plants, sources of pollution that can worsen heart and lung diseases.
When the air quality is not okay, we want to bring awareness to that so we can make positive change for our communities and for the next generations to come.
Juan Rosas is with the Hispanic Access Foundation, which recently launched El Aire que Respiramos, or the air we breathe. It's an effort to monitor air quality in 12 cities with large Hispanic populations in California, Texas, Nevada, Idaho, and Illinois. The group will place sensors at community centers, churches, and schools to measure air pollution. The data will help people know when local air quality is bad so they can take action to stay safe and push for change.
That is the goal. It's not just collecting the data, but it's also advocacy work, training our local communities to know that they have a voice.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
There's a good chance that the food you buy locally was grown in a field where pesticides were sprayed. The fight over the use of these chemicals within agriculture saw new developments this year, leading to renewed calls for stronger enforcement against violators, as well as a tighter regulatory schedule. Mike Morin has more in South Dakota.
Pesticides are still common in agriculture. Organic producers who avoid them have seen ups and downs in pushing for stronger regulations, and they point to a South Dakota example of the harm associated with widespread use among neighboring farms. At the heart of the regulatory fight is the application of the weed-killing pesticide dicamba and how it can drift from one farm to another. Last month, a federal court blocked over-the-top spraying of dicamba products, but the EPA followed with an order to allow the spraying of existing supplies. Glenn Pulse co-owns an organic farm in Vermilion and says a 2017 drift incident had a big impact on his operation.
Our entire farm was covered. We lost a lot of livestock. Thousands of bees were killed.
It also resulted in health concerns for his family, having to regain his organic farmer certification and a legal battle over restitution. Groups such as the National Family Farm Coalition have been fighting what they call the deregulation of these chemicals, arguing the drift and runoff effect has damaged millions of crops. Dicamba manufacturing companies deny responsibility, instead blaming farmers who apply it for not following guidelines. And the EPA says there were already millions of gallons of dicamba in circulation prior to the court's ruling, prompting the agency's order. Pulse feels there are farmers who are careful in spraying chemicals, but he wants stronger enforcement against those he describes as loose cannons.
The guys that are not following the labels and are spraying in weather conditions that are not favorable, that is where I would say 90% of the problems are happening with drift incidents.
His calls for better responses to these incidents coincide with policy demands to heavily restrict dicamba products. Meanwhile, South Dakota Congressman Dusty Johnson is the main sponsor of a bill supporters say would assure uniformity in national pesticide labeling under federal law. But opponents argue it would limit longstanding state and local pesticide safety rules. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
In more environmental news, the nation's plastic industry emitted nearly 63 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions in 2021. That's about as much as 15 coal-fired power plants, according to a new report. Yet many states, including Ohio, plants are built and expanded over the last decade, have received tax breaks or subsidies from state and local governments. Nadia Ramlagan reports from Columbus.
The plastics industry is releasing illegal pollution, but rarely faces discipline for environmental permit violations. According to a new Environmental Integrity Project report, companies producing plastics emitted nearly 63 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions in 2021, about as much as 15 coal-fired power plants. Alexander Shakevich with the Environmental Integrity Project points out that while many people in industries are now trying to minimize their use of fossil fuels, the plastics industry is moving in the opposite direction. She says people may not be aware that plastic is produced primarily from oil and natural gas.
It's been expanding at an exponential rate and causing a cascade of environmental problems, not just greenhouse gas pollution, but also litter. A lot of these products, they can't be recycled. And so essentially they wind up littering our oceans and our waterways.
The toxic chemicals emitted during plastics production have been linked to asthma, bronchitis, and cancer. Nationwide, more than two-thirds of those living within 3 miles of the factories that manufacture the main ingredients in plastic products are people of color. Shakevich says that many plastic plants built or expanded over the last decade have received tax breaks or subsidies from state and local governments, worth nearly $9 billion. She adds, the data show that trend is likely to continue.
Our report identified at least 10 new plants and 23 expansion projects at existing facilities that have been proposed. They could add an additional 35 million tons of greenhouse gases per year if those plants move forward.
One of the expanded plants is located in Ohio. According to the report, the new projects would produce ethylene or polyethylene, but the industry is also planning to increase production of PET, the type of plastic primarily used for packaging. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 29th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Matea Carlin, Chris Gow, Sam Bowman, and Jasmine Moss. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and